Do you see more law enforcement going after these groups who are using hate speech and putting cuffs on people so we show them that some action is better than no action?
We will absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech.
So the Attorney General of the United States will handcuff you for your speech.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
This is going very well.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Good Lord.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much, and welcome to another edition of the Bradcast. Delighted to have you here. And we have got a lot to get to today.
For a change.
And I mean a lot. Even more than usual, Desi Doyen. How you doing?
Doing okay.
All
holding
right.
up.
Good. Glad to hear you are holding up. If time allows, we'll get to your Green News Report.
Oh, little time bit later will allow.
We'll see about that. Anyway, we have been watching over the past 8 years. I'm sorry, over the past 8 months. It just seems like 8 years since Donald Trump has taken office again. Some fascinating, and not in a good way, new dynamics sort of overtaking our federal court system. Generally speaking, though not that generally speaking, we've seen a ton of cases being brought in federal court in opposition to the Trump administration's extraordinary, unprecedented actions on one thing after another, from mass, almost random firings of government employees across dozens of federal agencies, the very specific firings of decades-long experienced top agency personnel for clearly political reasons, because Trump viewed these career professionals as somehow his political opponents, simply because perhaps they were appointed by Joe Biden or Barack Obama. The complete or near complete shutdowns of entire federal agencies and departments, from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to the Department of Education, to the attempted takeover of supposedly independent federal commissions like the National Labor Relations Board, or Trump's recent, so far, failed attempts to fire a governor appointed by Joe Biden to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, to the administration's attempted rescissions of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in spending already appropriated by Congress, mass roundups and deportations of migrants by federal authorities, and the deployment of the U.S. military into American cities against the wishes of state and local authorities, just to name a few of the major unprecedented upheavals and attempted upheavals by the Trump administration in the 8 months since taking office for his second term. Dozens of those efforts have been challenged in federal court cases, and many of them, the majority, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, have resulted in temporary injunctions of the administration's actions by the lower courts, attempting to pause the unprecedented and potentially unlawful upheavals until the merits of the challenges against them could be heard in full by lower U.S. District Court judges and the appeals courts just above them. U.S. District Court judges, in case after case after case, have in fact paused many of those actions, only to have those temporary stays appealed by the Trump administration to appellate courts, which have also, many of them, confirmed the temporary pauses of the lower court, only to have those appeals court rulings taken to the U.S. Supreme Court on an emergency basis, or what the administration deems in any event to be an emergency, as they hope to undo the temporary lower court rulings in order to carry out their planned policies before a full trial and ruling on the merits in the lower courts. As you know, in case after case after case, on the Supreme Court's emergency docket, often referred to as the shadow docket, where emergency decisions are now made more and more frequently without benefit of an actual trial or hearing or even substantive evidence and argument presented to the high court, and without the court majority in most cases explaining their decision to affirm or, more frequently, overturn the lower court injunctions and stays pending trial. While the corrupted Supreme Court has been ruling in case after case in favor of the administration and against the lower courts, usually with no explanation whatsoever, those rulings are, generally speaking, only temporary. The rulings by the court on the emergency docket are only for now. They allow the Trump administration to have their way for now. Let's say the mass firings of hundreds or thousands of people from an agency, or the deportation of migrants to another country, or the withholding of congressionally appropriated federal spending, or on anything from U.S. foreign aid to critical cancer research here at home. But in theory, all of that is only for now. The high court is essentially clearing the way for the administration to move forward with their policy while the policy itself is being challenged in the lower courts. In many cases, however, the ruling at the high court means that the damage of those policies is actually done, and it's difficult to put the genie back in the bottle even if the administration ends up losing the full case on the merits in the lower courts once a full trial and hearing on the merits has been completed. Well, we are now at the stage where we are beginning to see more and more such cases, cases where the main action was first blocked by the lower courts only to be allowed by the Supreme Court anyway on a supposedly temporary basis while the case is heard in full below. And where the administration, just as the lower courts had previously believed likely, is actually losing those cases, first at the district court level and then at the appeals court level. So a bunch of the cases where the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to proceed with their policies initially, despite the lower courts finding those policies to be unlawful, a lot of those cases are now finally being rejected again at the lower courts, this time after full trials, with those district court decisions now beginning to be confirmed at the appeals court as well, as many of these cases will soon then be returning once again to the U.S. Supreme Court as the Trump administration ultimately challenges their lower court losses once again at the Supreme Court, though this time for real. In cases where the high court will, in theory, hear the cases in full on their merits and issue their final supposedly precedent-setting ruling one way or another. We now know that in case after case, they have sided with the administration and against their own lower courts on those temporary decisions. And now we're beginning to see more of those cases heard by the appeals court, and we'll soon see them heard by the Supremes, when we will finally learn if, as suspected, the corrupted Supreme Court, featuring three justices appointed by Trump himself, is as corrupted as many of us now believe it to be. One such case, likely to come again before the Supreme Court very soon after they allowed it to proceed despite lower court injunctions earlier this year, is the firing of tens of thousands of workers across a whole bunch of federal agencies that was initially put on hold by the lower courts, only to be allowed to proceed by the Supremes on a supposedly temporary basis. But now the lower court has issued a ruling in the case after hearing the full merits, and as expected, it did not go well for the government. As our friend Keith Barber wrote in his coverage over at Daily Kos over the weekend, Donald Trump's Office of Personnel Management, or OPM, ordered the firings of tens of thousands of employees across dozens of unrelated federal agencies earlier this year. The OPM directed that the firings be characterized as due to poor performance of those workers. A lie, writes Barber. No performance review was ever conducted. The firings were simply blanket, across the board, and cruelly administered, with recipients receiving an OPM-mandated email falsely characterizing their firing as being for poor performance. Various fired employees and their unions sued. A federal judge issued a temporary injunction against the firings, but the Supreme Court stayed that temporary injunction pending a full ruling on the merits by the trial judge, and that ruling was, in fact, in this case, released late last week. It did not go well for the Trump administration. As Barbara details, the judge found the government's argument to be a, quote, sham, and full of, quote, fabrications and, quote, chicanery by the Trump administration. In the words of the exasperated judge, quote, the administrative record submitted by the government is a sham. It does not facilitate judicial review. It frustrates it. That said, those thousands of federal government workers were long ago allowed to be fired or put on leave by the Supreme Court, which had blocked the lower court's injunctions. Which means that even though the lower court has now fully ruled on the merits, it may be too late to bring back those thousands of workers to their jobs. In many cases, the departments at which they worked have been decimated or dissolved entirely in their absences. Well, I had originally wanted to talk to Keith Barber about this case that he wrote about over the weekend. In the ensuing days, and especially on Tuesday, there have been case after case after case and legal issue after legal issue at both the federal and state level that I want to talk about. And I know that Keith has also been following some of these cases closely, from the Trump administration's new threats to go after perceived political foes following the murder of Republican activist Charlie Kirk last week, to a lawsuit filed on Monday by longtime federal prosecutor in New York, Maureen Comey, apparently because she was fired because she's the daughter of Trump's perceived enemy, former FBI Director James Comey, to state-level rulings in the 2020 election theft conspiracy case against Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants in Georgia, and much more, including Donald Trump's new ridiculous defamation lawsuit for $15 billion against the New York Times, apparently for printing stuff that Donald Trump does not like. Joining us now to try and make sense of as many of those disturbing and breaking stories as possible is our old friend Keith Barber, a former lifelong Republican and attorney who now frequently contributes to the Progressive Daily Kos under the pen name Keith DB. Oh, Mr. Barber, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you very much, Brad. Good to be back.
A busy day for a change, it seems. We've got a lot to get to with you, more than I had originally planned. So thanks for working through as much of this as we can today. But it's been a while, Keith. How are you enjoying the autocracy so far?
I'm scared.
Yeah?
I have kids who live in Germany, and they keep asking me if we have an exit plan.
Yikes. Do you?
No, not Uh-oh. Yet.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to start with, before you exit, I want to start with your coverage of that OPM case, because I think it kind of offers a preview of where much of this could be going in the months ahead. What it may signal on a larger level. But first, is my characterization of how these cases have been moving forward from the district court level to the appeals court level to the Supreme Court shadow docket, then back down again for a full trial on the merits at the lower courts, only to soon return to the Supreme Court. Is that generally accurate as you see it, as I characterized it there?
Yes, that was very well stated. It will be interesting to see how many of these actually get back up all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The court will have to be somewhat judicious in what it takes, because while about 10,000 applications for cert before the Supreme Court are filed every year, the Supreme Court agrees to hear only about 100 cases. And, you know, how many of them can be these?
Well, in the case of these cases, if they don't want to hear, if they like the ruling at the lower court, they can just simply refuse to hear the case, and that in that event, the lower court ruling stands, right?
That's correct.
So essentially, if they take one of these cases that they've already reviewed on the shadow docket, the Trump administration loses at the lower court. If they take it, can we assume anything about that and the fact that that means they may want to overturn the lower courts?
Yes, I think that if they take these cases, there's a very good chance that this Supreme Court will overturn these decisions.
Yikes.
I think that's, I think that's indicated by the shadow docket decisions.
The well, in the case of, and this is one of those cases that was, I don't want to say heard at the shadow docket, but it was decided temporarily on the shadow docket that, yeah, Donald Trump could go ahead and fire thousands of workers. Well, now that case has actually been heard. They weren't actually fired for poor performance at all. That was all a lie. What did the district court judge find ultimately in this case after hearing the full merits of the challenge by these federal workers and their unions?
Well, he got a little dig in at the Supreme Court because the effect of the Supreme Court's order was, according to this judge, that he could no longer return this case to, the status quo prior to the people being fired, because they've been fired now. It's been weeks or months since they've been fired. They've moved on to different jobs. The organization itself has been fundamentally changed, with many of the jobs eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
So, he was, in his order, blocking the terminations, attempting to preserve the status quo until the more measured decision, the final decision, could be made in the case. And the Supreme Court didn't let him do that. And so now the remedy that would normally be provided is no longer really available, is the point the judge made. And so he had to fashion a different remedy that really is, one could argue, is a hollow one. That it's kind of pleasant to see the judge required that the government eat some crow on this and rescind their characterization of the firings as for poor performance. But that's about all they're going to get out of this.
I mean, are they still allowed to be fired? Is he essentially saying, well, there are no jobs to come back to, so the firings stand? You just have to make it clear that it wasn't for cause. It wasn't because they were poor performance.
Yes, the firing stand.
And I mean, it seems that the judge got it right in the first place when he put a hold on the firings in the first place. But because the Supreme Court said, no, go ahead and fire him, does A, that signal, should that signal in those kind of cases that, yeah, that is where they are going? And B, didn't it used to be the emergency docket was used, in fact, the way the lower court judges had used it, to preserve the status quo, to just, prevent irreparable harm until after the case could be heard in full?
Yeah, the more frequent application of the emergency docket would have been for the higher level court to say, no, we're going to preserve the status quo while a lower court considers this, after the lower court refused to preserve the status quo. That would have been the more frequent application of the emergency docket, and this is an undoing of it. It's difficult to say what the reasoning of the Supreme Court is in doing it, because they don't provide a reason. They have these be, unsigned decisions, per curiam decisions, where the judge doesn't even sign it, and they provide no explanation or rationale whatsoever. Now, what's interesting is that the dissents provide their rationale.
Mm-hmm.
You read the decision, and it's just something that we've decided this, and then you'll see, a dissent or two in these decisions from the liberal judges, in which they flat out say that this is an abuse of the shadow docket. It's unprecedented. We shouldn't be doing it. Probably the most entertaining statement in that regards was one of the dissenting judges likened it to Calvin ball.
Mm-hmm.
where, you know, there's only one rule in Calvin Ball, and that rule is that there are no rules. And then the judge added, though, in this case, there is a second rule, and that second rule is that Trump always wins.
Yep. Now, that was Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson referring to one of my favorite comic strips of all time, Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, great one.
Yeah. I mean, Trump always wins. I mean, that does seem to be the rule, and the new rule, and I'm glad that Justice Jackson came out and said it. I mean, I was going to ask what has changed, in your opinion, from the time when, you know, the emergency docket at the Supreme Court would be used to protect the status quo until the case was over. Now it seems to be reversed. Lower courts are protecting the status quo. The Supreme Court is saying, nah, the hell with that. Go ahead and do whatever Trump wants. What has changed as you see it, in your opinion, that has turned things on its head like this?
I think the simplest answer would be what you have said. We have a corrupt Supreme Court. Donald Trump corrupts everything he touches, to include the United States Supreme Court, and that's what's happened.
It's just as plain as that, isn't it?
I don't want to overthink it.
Yeah. I think you might be right. Now, a few more federal matters I want to hit with you before we get to a break, and then come back with some state matters, I guess. On Monday, I think it was, a longtime federal prosecutor Maureen Comey, the daughter of former FBI Director James Comey, who was fired by Donald Trump without a cause. His daughter was now fired without cause or explanation. She filed a wrongful termination lawsuit alleging she was retaliated against because of her father and or the perception of her own political beliefs. She was a longtime seasoned prosecutor, led on a lot of really important cases, including here during the Trump administration. Now, we saw a similar lawsuit a week or so ago from three long-serving top FBI officials, essentially charging that their terminations as well were politically motivated. What is your take on these specific cases charging inappropriate filings above and beyond the mass firings at OPM, but these very specific targeted cases? Is this, as with those mass firings, going to simply come down to five votes on the Supreme Court and how the politics of the rule of law now supposedly works in the USA?
I'm afraid that is a very likely end result to this. It's kind of interesting to read the complaints in those suits, you know, Comey's complaint and the three FBI officials, because, you know, like Comey points out, that she got the termination notice. It did not provide any reason for the termination, and it cited no statutory authority for the termination. It simply said, pursuant to the president's Article II authority under the United States Constitution, you know, you're fired. And so this is going to go through the courts, with the Trump argument being that the Constitution invests the executive power in the president of the United States, and the power to decide who is and is not in the executive branch is therefore his and his alone. And courts shouldn't even be reviewing the question. You're going to hear a lot of that. And, you know, I am, based on the pattern that we've seen with all of these other cases, to include, you know, the shadow docket stuff, I'm afraid the Supreme Court may buy that.
And this reference to the Article II authority, essentially, that's a constitutional, the Article II of the Constitution establishing the presidency. And we've seen that more and more in recent years. It sort of started under, really in full, I think, under the George W. Bush administration, this idea of the unitary executive, and that it established in the Constitution that anything that happens in any executive agency all comes under the control of the president of the United States. Therefore, he can do whatever he wants with the executive agency, and in this case with Maureen Comey, or with the three top officials at the FBI, can simply fire them for any reason, doesn't even need to give a reason. That's the unitary executive theory, and it is one that the Supreme Court has been getting more and more behind in recent years, and now sort of on steroids during the second Trump administration, it seems.
That's correct, and it's based on that provision that I stated to you. It's kind of, if the Constitution's first three articles, Article 1 is the legislature, that's Congress, and Article 2 is the executive branch, the presidency, and Article 3 is the judicial branch, and they all kind of start with essentially the same phrase. And that phrase is, in regards to Article 2, the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States of America. And in Article 1, it's the legislative powers, and in Article 3, it's the judicial power shall be vested in the Supreme Court. So you have this question of what is meant by the term executive power, and the President of the United States, you know, the Trump regime is going to say, that means that the President of the United States has the power to decide who's in the executive branch and who is not.
To basically do anything we want to do.
That's correct.
That's how I'm reading it. And it kind of seems like that's how the Supreme Court is reading it. We will see once more and more of these cases work their way back up to the high court. In the meantime, your fellow Daily Coast writer, Keith Barber, Emily Singer, she writes today, quote, in the wake of Charlie Kirk's death, Attorney General Pam Bondi on Monday declared that hate speech against the late right-wing activist is illegal hate speech, and that the government will now go after those who criticize Kirk. A blatantly unconstitutional action that Singer argues even Kirk himself would have disagreed with. Here's Pam Bondi on Monday speaking with Katie Miller, the podcasting wife of Trump's evil immigrant-hating right-hand man, Stephen Miller.
There's free speech and then there's hate speech. And there is no place, especially now, especially after what happened to Charlie, in our society.
Do you see more law enforcement going after these groups who are using hate speech and putting cuffs on people so we show them that some action is better than no action?
We will absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech.
We will target you for speech, hate speech in this case. Now, hate speech may be hateful, but it's not illegal, right? Keith Barber, as Republicans, by the way, used to love to remind us all of.
The hate speech is speech, and hateful speech is as protected by the Constitution as any other speech. It's kind of interesting. One of the seminal Supreme Court on this, kind of Brandenburg versus Ohio. Mm-hmm. And in Brandenburg versus Ohio, a member of the KKK openly advocated for violence against blacks and Jews, and encouraged it, and ended up being charged under an Ohio statute, and it went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, even speech that encourages violence is protected speech unless that speech is likely, is intended to, and is likely to induce immediate violence. So unless it meets any speech not meeting the Brandenburg test, is protected, unless, of course, a corrupt Supreme Court decides to say that that's not true anymore. And did you hear any of this kind of language from Pam Bondi and others when Melissa Hortman was assassinated and people like Senator Mike Lee was mocking it? Mm-hmm. Did you hear it, when Paul Pelosi was nearly assassinated? Charlie Kirk himself made light of it and mocked it and talked about how great it would be if somebody would bail the assailant out. If a true patriot would bail the assailant out.
But now, simply because the administration declares, oh, that joke, it's not a joke, it's actually hate speech, you can be cuffed for it. I mean, Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. It's speech that this administration and people indulge in all the time, and same thing. But they think that it only applies when the speech is against their side, and not when it's against Democrats. So I mean,
Emily Singer,
I don't know what to say about it.
Emily Singer over at Daily Kos points out that Charlie Kirk himself wrote in May of 2024, so just last year, Charlie Kirk wrote on Twitter, quote, "Hate speech does not exist legally in America. There's ugly speech, there's gross speech, there's evil speech, and all of it is protected by the First Amendment." Charlie Kirk wrote, adding, "Keep America free." Keith, down in Florida, you've had to deal with Pam Bondi as your own state attorney general for about, 8 years or so. Is she really this unfamiliar with the law, in this case, federal law, or does she just not care?
I think, at least what I hope, is that a lot of this is just pandering to their base and pandering to Trump, you know, and telling them, and that they don't intend to really follow through, at least in the fashion that she is suggesting that they will follow through. But it's obviously also intended to scare people. It is intended to intimidate the free expression of speech. It's intended to, I have strongly condemned the killing of Charlie Kirk, and I do, and I support the full weight of the law being brought against, his killer. But Charlie Kirk was a racist, sexist man who peddled in lies that are exceptionally damaging to our democracy. And I'm going to continue to say that because that is true. And I will not change him in death to something he was not in life. And that's all there is to it. So come get me, Pam.
Well, don't challenge her. She knows where you live, Keith. She also apparently, actually, please do challenge her. I'm just kidding. Just to make that clear, please do challenge her all you can. She also apparently, because this person does not seem, either she does not seem to understand the law or she just simply doesn't care. She also apparently vowed to prosecute companies that refused to print posters about Charlie Kirk. This was on Fox News. She said, quote, "If you want to go and print posters with Charlie's pictures on them for a vigil, you have to let them do that. We can prosecute you for that, for presumably refusing to print such posters," adding that she had the Justice Department's Civil Rights Unit looking at that issue right now. Well, am I nuts? Didn't the Supreme Court itself recently decide that if a baker in Colorado did not want to make a cake for a gay wedding, that he had the First Amendment right to not make that cake? But now printers must print a Charlie Kirk poster if anyone wants them to, or they will be prosecuted. What is exactly different here, Keith Barber?
Well, that's compelled speech. I mean, if there's one thing that is more pernicious and more tyrannical than restricting expression, it would be forcing expression, and it would be forcing the expression that affirms your regime. And that's what they're trying to do, suggesting that they would do. Civil rights. I mean, what's the protected class there? People with a political or a specific political perspective or the supposed protective class. No, that's political ideology has never been a protected class. And, you know, protected classes is normally associated with immutable characteristics like, you know, race and sex and sexual orientation and things like that. It's it's not political ideology.
Well, very quickly, because I got to get to a break here, Keith. But what's the difference between that cake, that baker cake baker case out of Colorado, where I would assume the judge ultimately, the Supreme Court ultimately ruled essentially in favor of the baker that he doesn't have to make a cake for a gay wedding. What's the difference there?
The gay couple in that case had a plausible argument that the baker was denying baking the cake because of their sex, because both of them were male.
Mm. And that's a protected class versus Charlie Kirk.
So where, in that you can at least articulate something like I just did that, mm-hmm. Presents a reasonable question of law for a court to resolve. I don't see, what the protected class can be for Charlie Kirk lovers at all.
And we should add, in the case of the baker, he was also arguing that it was his religious freedom to not bake this cake. Now, I don't buy that, but making that claim of religious freedom, there was at least a claim to be made. I'm not sure what the claim would be made if someone refused to print your I Love Charlie Kirk posters. Anyway, let me take a quick break here. We'll come back with Keith Barber. Please sit tight, my friend. We got more to talk to you about in some of the state cases, though several of these cases from the murder of the United Healthcare CEO to the Fani Willis case down in Georgia against Donald Trump for the 2020, trying to steal the 2020 election. Do seem to have national and federal implications. Also, Donald Trump has sued the New York Times. We'll try to get to all of that with Keith Barber and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report later this hour. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
All right. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, speaking with our old friend Keith Barber, who writes over at Daily Kos under the pseudonym Keith DB about all things related to law and the courts and everything else. He is himself a former attorney, a former lifelong Republican, a current resident of Florida, but we won't hold any of that against him. Okay, Keith. Couple of state-related stories here, as I said, albeit with national and federal implications. First, in New York, a state judge on Tuesday threw out terrorism charges against Luigi Mangione, rejecting the Manhattan District Attorney's theory in a state murder case that the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson was intended, quote, intended to evoke terror. Now, the other charges against Mangione, including second-degree murder, will in fact move forward, but the judge felt it was not terrorism. So what is the distinction here now in a world where, by the way, the Trump administration is essentially calling everything they don't like? All crimes are essentially terrorism, from their war on foreign drug cartels, oh, that's now narco-terrorism, to opposition to Trump and people like Charlie Kirk. Those are now left-wing terrorists, essentially. It's not just crime, but it's terrorism, too.
Well, yeah, that's what, interestingly, that was the charge brought by Alvin Bragg, the same prosecutor that went after Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rooted in state law,
mm-hmm.
In the state definition of what constitutes terrorism, because these were the state charges. And the judge said that legal slipper did not fit in on this foot. And I'm not sure. It's interesting because the judge noted that the New York terrorism law was closely modeled in terms of its language on the federal law. And the judge noted that the federal government, when it charged Mangione, did not charge him with terrorism. So, and, you know, the federal government under this regime is kind of notorious for overcharging, and when they do so, often overreaching. But they, even they didn't charge him with terrorism.
Say that again. I'm sorry. I spoke over you.
I think it was probably a good call to dismiss the terrorism charge.
When did Alvin Bragg charge Donald Trump with terrorism?
Well, he didn't charge him with terrorism, but he you know, his office investigated Trump for on the civil stuff and mm-hmm. so forth. And he, you know, he has attracted Trump's attention as being a bad person. And Trump has threatened, you know, to go after him with federal investigations.
I see. So it was Alvin Bragg who brought these particular charges against Mangione that were.
And Bragg said, we will continue to proceed on the other 9 charges against this guy to include murder.
Mm-hmm. All right, down in Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis will apparently remain disqualified from prosecuting the attempted election theft case against Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants after the Georgia Supreme Court on Tuesday declined to hear her appeal of the matter. She was originally removed from that case due to claims of an inappropriate relationship with one of her fellow prosecutors on the massive RICO racketeering case regarding Trump's attempt to muscle the Georgia Secretary of State to, quote, find him enough votes to flip the state after 2020, alleging that he had harassed Georgia election workers. He pushed phony fraud claims, and that a group of co-defendants, as we covered very closely on this show, unlawfully breached statewide voting systems in Coffee County, Georgia, beginning on January 7 of 2021. Now, a state panel might, I guess, reassign the case to another prosecutor at this point, but then that prosecutor can choose to drop the case entirely, as I understand it. Is that your understanding of this? And is this a case where they could drop the charges, for example, against Donald Trump, but continue against some of the other co-defendants in this case?
Yeah, another prosecutor might decide to do exactly that. And that prosecutor's excuse would be this, you know, the tagging on to the federal policy that you can't criminally prosecute a sitting president. And while that technically, you know, that's never been applied to a state question before, whether or not a state can prosecute a sitting president. The language in the Supreme Court's decision granting Trump immunity would certainly seem to support the idea that you can't do it. And so Trump would probably be out of it, even if the prosecution continues against other individuals in the case. And there are a lot of them.
Can a case go forward? I know it's different in each state, but if Donald Trump was sort of the linchpin of this conspiracy, and he's basically charged along with all of the co-defendants, if he, as the linchpin in the conspiracy, is allowed to not be tried in this case because he's become president, can you still try his co-conspirators who worked with him on the case?
Yeah, you can. I mean, in theory, you could get the mob boss, grant a mob boss immunity to testify against all of his underlings. But that's generally not the way it works. Generally, you know, the prosecution wants to get the mob boss most of all. And with the RICO statute, which was originally designed to deal with organized crime and to get the, you know, decapitate the heads of organized crime, be able to go after them, you know. And in this case, you're right in your characterization of it. The allegations in that case present Donald Trump is essentially the leader of the criminal scheme,
right?
And all the others were working for him in advancement of his criminal scheme. But the fact that they can't get him anymore doesn't mean that the others cannot be independently prosecuted. I'll be honest with you. I think that the smart money on this is that the prosecutions are probably all going to just die on the vine on this, but it's at least possible that others could proceed.
All right. Finally, for now on this front, Donald Trump on Monday promised to file a $15 billion defamation, $15 billion with a B dollar defamation case against the New York Times, because I guess he doesn't like their reporting or something. I haven't had time to review this 85-page complaint yet. I don't know if you have, Keith Barber, but do you have any thoughts on this case?
You know what? I have it on my up on my screen right now, and I have read some of it, and it's. I honestly think that Saturday Night Live or somebody should do a comedy skit where the whole thing is just read out loud because.
Really?
It reads like something President Trump himself would have personally wrote, because it's all about how great he is and his historic victory, you know, in both the Electoral College and the popular vote and winning all seven battleground states. This is all on the paragraph one on the first page, and, you know, with an electoral map, college map being presented, and how all of this means that, you know, Americans saw the truth of Donald Trump and the lies that had been spread about him. And that's just in the first page and a half, and it just gets worse from there. And it's nuts. It's interestingly, he cites the settlement with ABC where he got $15 million from them.
Yeah.
Well, ABC was attempting to do a merger and had to get, you know, antitrust clearance from the Federal Trade Commission to get it. And the $15 million that they did to settle Trump's defamation case on him was just a flat out bribe to get that FTC approval, which they eventually did. So I'm not aware of the New York Times having that issue. And I certainly hope that they don't settle this. And I would expect that not only would they prevail, but they would also get their money back on legal expenses under an anti-slap motion.
Yeah. I sure hope they do. I sure hope they fight this as a journalist, but frankly, as an American who sees this for what it is, I mean, it's just absurd. And the idea that, oh, Donald Trump won the last presidential election means the New York Times no longer has the right to the free press, the First Amendment.
It's insane. I'm reading it, you know, when you read it, and I encourage you, just read the first few pages before your mind can't tolerate it anymore, but it's just goofy as can be. And, you know, on the more serious note, political expression is the most protected expression of all under the First Amendment.
Well, it used to be the case, Keith, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that has made its way up to the Supreme Court that we all characterized as ridiculous until this corrupted Supreme Court saw it otherwise. So fingers crossed. I got to get out of here. I'm sorry, Keith. I'm running late, my friend. Thank you for hanging with me on all of these items and helping to pull them all together as they come tumbling in today and over the last few days. Really appreciate your help. Keith Barber, his work can be found over at dailycoast.com. He writes under the name Keith DB. You can also find him on the Blue Skies at Keith DB as well. Keith, really appreciate joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thank you, Brad. I had fun.
Thank you, brother. All right. Well, I'm afraid because we ran so long with Keith there, we won't be able to get to our Green News Report.
We are getting to the Green News Report next.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
that's coming up next right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
Once again, thanks to our friend Keith Barber there. He got to a lot, you know, he was going to come on and talk to us about one thing, and then there was 10 other things that broke between the time we asked him to come and join us in that, and hey, can you talk to us about the other thing? Sure, no problem.
Yes, thankfully he can
He's
do that.
He's a good man. Thank God for Keith Barber. All right, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Summer heat isn't just getting more intense due to climate change, but it's hanging on longer into the fall season.
It's not your imagination. Summers are getting hotter and lasting longer into fall. U.S. taxpayers will pay billions in new fossil fuel subsidies under Republicans' big budget bill. Plus,
in the last 36 months, a pretty untold story of just extraordinary amounts of clean energy surging into the world's energy system.
Global renewable energy investment is surging, just not in the
U.S. All of those embarrassing outrages and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
If oil was of trivial value on this planet, how many wars and coups and assassination attempts would have been averted? Humans are, you know, altogether too good at starting wars, but figuring out how to start one over sunshine will be a trick.
There you go. Underestimating Donald Trump again. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it may be September, but the summer is continuing.
Yes, yes it is. Some parts of the U.S. are still getting blasts of summer heat. And a new analysis shows that summer's heat lasts longer in the U.S. than ever before and now stretches into fall thanks to man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels.
Thanks, man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels.
Climate data firm Climate Central found that in 227 major U.S. cities, hot temperatures now extend at least 10 days longer into fall than they did in the 1970s. That's on average nationally. But in Texas and Florida, summer's heat now extends more than a month or more into fall.
They deserve it.
More heat days mean higher risks for heat-related illnesses, especially among vulnerable groups, plus increased fire danger and higher energy bills, especially costly for schools. Research shows that if heat-trapping pollution keeps rising, these summer temperatures will keep stretching later and later.
Mm.
A different study concludes that man-made climate change has amplified all global heat waves since at least the year 2000. The groundbreaking climate study in the journal Nature also tied individual fossil fuel companies to these extreme heat events, finding that at least a quarter of those heat waves would have been, quote, virtually impossible without the climate pollution from the 14 biggest fossil fuel and cement companies. Those are responsible for the lion's share of the world's carbon pollution. Tying increasingly severe and frequent heat waves to specific companies could potentially be a game changer for climate liability lawsuits seeking to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for climate damages.
I like it.
So it's not great news, though, that thanks to Trump and Republicans' big, ugly budget bill, taxpayers will be paying billions of dollars more in new fossil fuel subsidies. A new report by Oil Change International finds that the Republicans' legislation shovels $4 billion in new subsidies to the oil and gas industry every year for the next 10 years. That's in addition to the more than $30 billion a year taxpayers already give in pre-existing existing subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. Fossil fuel companies spent at least $500 million to get Donald Trump elected last year, and Trump and Republicans since have blocked cheaper, cleaner alternatives like solar, wind, and even public transportation, anything that reduces dependence on fossil fuels. So, taxpayers pay the industry to produce, then pay for the product, and then pay again for climate damages.
Well, they got us coming and going and going again, don't they?
Even as electricity demand rises, Trump's war on clean energy has killed nearly $19 billion in clean energy projects within the last year.
Wow.
But despite that, the Los Angeles Times reports that over the summer, renewable energy generated nearly 25% of U.S. electricity generation, and California, the fourth largest economy in the world, is using 40% less natural gas to produce electricity than they were 2 years ago, thanks to solar, wind, and batteries.
Thanks, solar, wind, and batteries.
Globally, as the U.S. retreats from renewable energy, China is becoming the world leader. China is leading the global transition using technology invented in the United States that Republicans and Trump are now abandoning. On Democracy Now!, veteran environmentalist and author Bill McKibben called it a huge win for China.
China has been leading that effort. We know about petrostates. China's the world's first electrostate. We're just handing it all to China in order to appease the oil industry.
McKibben is partnering with environmental groups to hold rallies across America on Sunday, September 21st, to push for expanding solar and wind energy at the state and local level.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
What a way to save our souls this endless summer.
If our souls are to be saved
from this endless summer that never ends, the heat waves that keep going and going and going and going.
We will find out. Thank you very much, Desiree. Desi Doyen is, of course, our producer. Thanks again to our guest today, Keith Barber of Daily Kos, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we have ever done since the beginning of time, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site as you see fit. However, if you stop by bradblog.com, you will have the opportunity to hit one of those donate buttons to help us stay on your public airwaves and do what we try to do every day over them as this Trump administration is getting, I don't want to say scarier and scarier, but scarier and scarier. So we could use your help along the way. Bradblog.com/donate if you'd like to go straight there. We thank you in advance. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you'll find me on all the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
What a way to save our souls these